This is a Dog Guide Handlers Australia audio presentation.
I'd just like to extend a very warm welcome to Penny Stevenson. We're delighted to have you with us today and have you speak with us. Thank you for sharing your time and your story. Penny is a vision impaired dog guide user and also a vision impaired orientation and mobility instructor in Victoria, and she's going to share her personal and professional experiences with us. And I'll just ask Penny, are you happy to take questions after your...
Absolutely.
Yeah, and when it comes to question and discussion time, if you could just state your name before you speak so that we know who's speaking. Thank you, and welcome, Penny.
Thanks very much, Rowena, and I'd just like to say congratulations on getting this association happening, because it's been something that I've been interested in for a very, very long time but never sort of got off the ground, so... it's very exciting. So I've been a dog guide user for 11 years. My first dog, Valkyrie, she was from Guide Dogs Victoria, and my current dog, I've had sort of, this is my second and a half dog. The last two were both from Seeing Eye Dogs. So, yeah, I've had my current dog for just probably coming up, I think, 3 years this year. So she's four and a half. And her name's Hermione, and she's going okay. She's a golden retriever lab cross, and she's a pretty good worker. So I suppose I'd like to just start by talking about my current career as a vision impaired O&M, and what got me into that. I suppose as a young person, I was probably about 11 or so when I first had my first O&M lesson, because my mum wouldn't let me walk to school without being taught how to cross the roads. So I met up with my first instructor, and I thought she was pretty cool. I thought, what an awesome job. You know, she gets to be outside all day working with people. What a great job. And so I sort of, you know, put that in the back of my head. And I, you know, being 11, didn't really think a lot more about it. But then, you know, coming towards the end of school, I thought, oh, that'd be a pretty good job. But of course, at that stage, there were still driving licence requirements. And, you know, I talked to quite a few people in the field, and there was a lot of ambivalence about having a blind person doing the job from both sides, from both the blind community and from instructors in the field. So I thought, oh, well, I'll just sort of, you know, put that on the back burner and go off and do some other things. And so I went off and I sort of studied bits and pieces for the next 10 or so years. I ended up completing my degree in secondary education, and it was a double degree in arts and education, so I'm a fully qualified secondary teacher. But of course, being a vision impaired teacher, you know, poses its own problems, and I was finding it quite hard to convince schools to employ me as a vision impaired teacher with my dog intact in tow. So I decided I'd go and do my my master's in special education up in Sydney, so I could be a teacher of the vision impaired. So that was great. My dog's just caught a fly or a moth or something. I just had to go and see what she's got into. Good dog, well done. Oh, well, it's gone, whatever it was. I did that just in time for Vision Australia to close the Burwood School and disband its visiting teacher service. And I could get a job with the Department of Education here in Victoria, but they're not very supportive of people with vision impairments. You have to have your own car to get around to the different schools, and particularly in the region where I'd like to, well, where I could be working, the team itself isn't very functional, so it's sort of very unsupportive of people with vision impairments. I wasn't able to pursue that at that time, so I was looking around for some other things to do, and I'd still been toying with the idea of orientation and mobility, and... there was an opportunity in New Zealand to go over and be on a scholarship over there to become a rehabilitation teacher in orientation and mobility and adaptive daily living, and they would pay all your tuition costs and plus a bit of a scholarship and give you a job for 2 years. So, and if they didn't give you a job, you didn't have to pay back your bursary. So I thought, well, that sounds like a pretty good deal. I get to prove that I can do the job, because I think that was always going to be the hardest thing, was proving to people in Australia that I could actually do the job, because there'd been a lot of people before me go through and do the various sort of TAFE level courses at the various certificates in O&M, but no one had ever been able to get a job afterwards. And I thought, well, actually, by being able to demonstrate that I've done the job for 2 years, that's fairly strong evidence that I can do it. And I figured also, if at the end of the course they couldn't find me a job, well, I hadn't lost anything. I'd got the qualifications, and I wouldn't have to pay back, my course fees. So I thought it was a pretty win-win situation. And added to that, there had also been a previous O&M instructor over there who was a totally blind long cane user. And so I thought, oh, well, it's fairly good evidence that, it can be done. I went over there and I did my training. And unfortunately for me, I didn't get to meet the guy over there who had been doing the job. He has gone back into music profession. And despite my repeated attempts to try and contact him, I wasn't able to sort of pick his brains about the techniques that he uses. I have pretty good low vision, well, pretty bad low vision. I've got about 160 in my left eye and 360 in my right, so I'm certainly not totally by any stretch of the imagination, but at the same time, my vision loss is significant. I would have liked to be able to pick up a few more non-visual techniques than what I did. I certainly rely a lot on the vision that I have. I do the job, I think, fairly much as a sighted person would do it, because that was certainly the way that we were taught. I was working with other sighted people. I was being taught by sighted people. And I certainly do the job with very few modifications. I think I perhaps use my hearing a little bit more, I listen to the sounds that people make, perhaps more than sighted people would, and I can provide a lot more empathy about what people are going through than what sighted people would. But in terms of what I actually do, there's not very many modifications I make. I was actually quite surprised. I always thought that an O&M instructor just turned up at your house and just went out for a walk with you and did no planning, and they just used their eyes to sort of see what you couldn't. But the reality is that most O&Ms actually do quite a bit of planning before they go out with you. And so they'll go out and assess the route before they go. And I just do that in a slightly different way. I had a couple of good taxi drivers who, I'd sort of say, oh, look, can we just do a quick drive around the streets before you drop me off, and, I'd sort of get them to have a bit of a scout around and see what was going on. And then I also, depending on the level of vision someone has, the more vision that they have, the less planning I have to do. The less vision, the more planning I do, because the more sort of information you need to know about possible obstacles and things like that, whereas, if people have usable vision, they're actually able to do a lot of that stuff for themselves, which is really handy. In terms of using a dog guide in my job, so I've been in the role now just over 2 years, and I'm actually always sort of changing and growing in my confidence, I suppose, in the role, and feeling more confident about what I'm doing and, how my dog sort of fits into that. When I first started out, I wouldn't take her along very much, particularly to new clients. Most of the clients that I work with are older vision loss due to macular degeneration in their sort of 70s plus. And, I still tend not to take her along to many of my initial assessments because often it's a big step that my clients are actually getting, talking to someone about orientation and mobility in the first place. And I don't always want to throw a dog into that process. But, having said that, I found a lot of my clients say to me, "Oh, you've got a dog. Oh, you should have brought it. Oh, that would have been so lovely." So, I am getting much better at sort of, asking people now. It's still a work in progress in terms of that. I take her out with me when I'm doing more complex routes with people. So if we're travelling on public transport, going to the city, things like that. There are some sort of limitations that I find. If I'm teaching escalators, I find it very hard to do that with her in tow. So if I'm going to do escalator work, I'll leave her back in the office. For certain things, it's sometimes, just easier not to have her with me. So, sort of just depends. And then, of course, also there's that fine line between... O&M instructors are quite protective about long canes and white canes and things like that, and so sometimes it's you've got to sort of be a bit careful about sort of not sending everyone over to the dark side of dog guide mobility, really, and planting that seed in everybody's head. But yeah. I've actually found that I can be a great advocate for both sides because when I was over in New Zealand, I spent quite a lot of time without a dog. I was without a dog for about 7 months between the time that my second one retired and I got my third. And so it really gave me some great insight on living with the cane because I was studying the course at the same time. It really gave me a really different perspective about cane use and actually made me almost consider not getting a third dog because, I was just really enjoying the power of the cane. Like, it's a pretty amazing piece of technology considering it's just a piece of metal. And so I think I can provide quite a balanced approach to, for people who are interested in getting a dog. And, it's one of the parts that I really like about my job is, sort of being able to, talk to people realistically about what it's like to live with a dog and why they might want to consider getting one and why they might not. And it's one of my favourite parts, I suppose. I've got a couple more little focus questions. I suppose in terms of getting materials in accessible format when I was training, it wasn't too much of a problem because people had sort of... been through various bits of courses in the past. There was quite a bit that was sort of around in the ether, I suppose, floating around. Some of it wasn't in great shape. It was scanned and it was poorly done scans and things like that. But I managed to get most of the information that I needed without too much hardship. A lot of the material in journals and things like that is quite accessible. A lot of the sort of current thinking was available to me for writing essays and things like that. Some of the older stuff was harder to get, but it's not too bad, and it's great. The big Bible of orientation and mobility is published by the American Foundation for the Blind, and it's they're really fantastic about producing material in alternative format. So you can actually buy the big textbook in already in electronic format, which is just fantastic. I haven't actually bought the new version, but it's on my wish list of things to do. Yeah, I'll get there in the end.
You know what that's called, Penny?
Foundations of Orientation and Mobility.
Okay,
and
thanks.
I think it's...
Oh, sorry, it's Geraldine.
Yeah, that's okay. I think it's by... it used to be by Blatch and Wiener or something like that, but... you'll be able to find it on the website. It's a huge book. It's now in two volumes. It used to just be one volume, but now it's two, so it's massive.
Okay,
no,
thanks.
Big red book. Yeah, I suppose the reactions from clients that I've had have been really quite positive. I was expecting to have quite a lot more, I was expecting people to be a bit more worried about having a vision impaired instructor than what they have been. I think because of the amount of negativity there was in the blindness community when I was initially looking into doing the course, I was expecting, you know, for people to be constantly saying, oh, I don't want her, give me a sighted instructor, thanks so kindly. But that actually hasn't been the case. I actually haven't had many of the sort of, most of the clients who were in the, you know, were active in on ZipL and things like that, aren't part of my patch really. So, you know, I haven't had to work with any of them. And also, you know, the reality of the job is that most of them are working and don't need a lot of orientation mobility. So, haven't had to have a lot of work with them. But the clients who I have worked with in terms of, you know, congenitally blind sort of middle-aged people, you know, it's been really positive. And for the newly blinded people, I think it's been really great because, you know, I've been through vision loss. I've had experiences under total blindfold, which is, of course, isn't the same as being totally blind. But, you know, I think that there's a lot of the similar, you know, struggles and fears and stuff that we all sort of go through, that we all go through, and that I can sort of empathise with and share my experiences. And, yeah, I think for a lot of my clients it's been quite beneficial having someone with a vision impairment. One of my clients said that she wouldn't go back to having a sighted instructor. She only wants blind and vision impaired ones, which is was really quite fantastic. I thought she's really great. It's been really good. And of course, for the older generation, you know, a lot of them, because I turn up at their house and often I'll fold up my cane before I go in the door, particularly for the initial assessment, and, you know, they say, oh, I didn't realise you had a vision impairment. Oh, that's fantastic, you know, and, it's been quite fun to have those sorts of experiences and just sort of, you know, change the perspective about, you know, what it is to be blind, and, it's been really good. And I'm also really enjoying, there's been quite a few other vision impaired people go through the course recently. We've got one instructor who has a vision impairment working in our Canberra office, and we've got another person with a vision impairment going through our course down in Melbourne this year, and I got to have him on while he was on prac, and so it was really good. You know, both of us would turn up, and he's got really good low vision. He's sort of on that real border between legal blindness and not being able to drive, basically. And so it was really great for him to be able to share his experiences too with clients, because he's a monocular user. He uses large print. In fact, he actually doesn't use very much assistive technology at all. And so it was, you know, it was just really great for both of us to be able to go out to clients and share our experiences. So that was really great. And in terms of my colleagues, they've been all really supportive, just really encouraging. When I was in New Zealand, like before I'd even been in the course, maybe, you know, 3 weeks, there was a really obnoxious person, another instructor, who was like, oh, I don't think you can do this, you know, I don't think you should even be here. I was just like blown away. I was like, oh my God, I haven't even started the course and she's already telling me that I shouldn't be doing it. And yeah, that was pretty full on, but the reality was that I very quickly proved that I, you know, should be doing the course and that I was able to do the work. So, and my colleagues are really fully supportive of me. When I get back to work, I've got a younger child. He's 4 years old, and his mother is going to have a meeting with all of the workers that are involved in his case. and she would like to know exactly what my vision impairment is and just how I think I can do the job, you know, and do it the same as anyone who can see. And, you know, a lot of that is all about her acceptance of her child having a vision impairment and coming to terms with that. And so, you know, like, I could get quite antsy about that and say, no, you know, I don't have to prove myself to you. But at the same time, I think it's going to be a really good learning experience for her to sort of come to terms with the potential that her son has. But really in the 2 years, that's the first time that I've had to justify myself to anyone, which is pretty awesome because I was expecting to have to do it much more. Sorry. I think that really sort of sums me up. I'm more than happy to take some questions and sort of talk to those if you would like.
Yeah. Penny, can you hear me? Giselle,
yeah.
From Sydney.
Yeah.
Wonderful talk, Penny. Very inspiring. And, you know, congratulations to you for your hard work. One question I had is, I guess, when I'm legally blind too, and I manage when it's my own mobility, but if I'm with another blind person next to me, I found it sort of difficult to, especially when the case where I was trying to guide someone who was visiting, and she was vision impaired,
yep.
too. And I found it really difficult to focus on my own mobility and also be attentive to the other person's needs, you know, and
yes.
care, right? So how do you do that? How do you split that focus, especially when you've got a child involved, like that thing, you know, that we cannot be as responsible as themselves as an adult? How do you split, like, because when you're guiding, you also have to be worried about your own mobility as well as the other person's mobility. So how
Absolutely.
Do you do that?
Absolutely. You know, that's a really valid point. I find that that's one of the benefits of having, I mean, there's sort of, there's about three parts to that question.
Yeah.
One is that in order to be able to, I don't think that becoming an orientation mobility instructor is for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
You certainly have to be at a point in your own mobility where you don't need to think about it so much, you know, that you can actually be focused in on someone else. And there's been a few people who have apparently tried to do the course in the past, but their mobility skills weren't at that level where they didn't need to sort of think about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that for myself, I can do that quite easily in a simple environment. So, you know, taking someone down local streets and things like that, even in a local business district, I find it not too bad, but that's one of the reasons that I do enjoy having my dog in those more in complex environments, because it really means that I can actually focus my attention much more on the client that I'm working with than when I'm using my cane. However, having said that, I actually, and it's a technique that I also heard Daniel Kish from World Access to the Blind, you know, who's the absolute guru in echolocation and whatever, he sort of said something similar, is that you actually end up sort of creating like an awareness bubble that extends around the two of you.
Okay.
And so you sort of end up expanding your concentration levels out to encapsulate that other person. So when I'm instructing, I will, if I'm using my cane, I sort of come back behind the person, but listen to the sounds of their cane and what they're doing, and sort of, I don't know, it's almost like I have this bubble around the two of us, so that then I'm concentrating on what their cane's doing and therefore what that means, you know, for the two of us. I don't know, I can't really explain it, put it into words well, but...
I understand.
And in terms of guiding, that is one of the changes that I have sort of made. I'm very lucky. My dog showed me very early on in our working life that she actually doesn't mind working on the right, and that was actually something that I exploited. And I've taught her how to do basic work on the right, so that I can swap sides. So if I do need to monitor someone, it works out better to have her on the right, I can. So if someone wants to be guided on my left arm, I can do that. If we're doing a road crossing and I have her on my right-hand side so that she's closer to the traffic, I can do that as well. And so that, you know, that's been a real benefit. And possibly something that I will look for in my next dog when I choose to get one, if I'm still doing the same job that I'm doing, because it's been really invaluable. But, you know, you're completely right. It is hard work. And for the first year or so, I was exhausted every night that I came home because I was using so much energy, mental energy, you know, working with people. But, you know, I've really acclimatised to it, and I'm, you know, I don't find it quite as fatiguing anymore. I mean, occasionally there'll be days I'll come home, I'm just, you know, it's been a full day, but, yeah, it's not nearly as, not every session is nearly as exhausting as it was.
I suppose it would be similar in some way to a mother, a blind mother having a child and having to encapsulate, as you said, that child, you know, in her protection, you know?
Exactly, I think you're right,
Thank you.
And it's also about choosing the environments too. If I'm not confident with someone's mobility skills, I'm not going to take them out into an environment. You know, if I can't, if I'm not sure that they're able to stop on a dime, or, you know, if I'm not sure that they're really up for it, because, I do have to be that little bit more. I can't wing it quite as much, I think, as a sighted person could.
Any other questions there? No.
Differences between guide dogs and CEDA? Any challenges? I don't know. Is there anything else that anyone wants to pick my brains about?
Oh, Geraldine here. Yeah, well, I've worked with guide dogs, three of them now, and a CEDA dog, finding my CEDA dog, who I've had for 6 months, absolutely excellent. Delighted with her. What's your experience been, Penny?
I had my first dog from Guide Dogs was, you know, my absolute soulmate. Like, she and I were just so perfectly matched that, you know, I don't think I'll ever get a dog like her.
We all have one of them, don't we?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it certainly wasn't, it wasn't because of the quality of the dog that I decided that I'd change schools. When I was younger, I actually was given a job by CEDA in their kennels. There was myself and another vision impaired person, both who had guide dogs. And, we were given a job by CEDA in their kennels, and I thought, wow, that's not something that a guide dog would ever do. There's no way that you'd find someone with a CEDA dog working in guide dog kennels, let alone actually working someone with vision impairment working in guide dog kennels. But, you know, that was a sort of another story. And so that was right back in the early days when they'd just changed over from Lady Nell and had become Seeing Eye Dogs Australia.
Yeah.
And at that stage, I personally, I mean, my dog was only brand new, so I wasn't prepared to get a dog from CEDA quite then. But even as she was getting older, I probably still wasn't quite ready. I didn't think that they had quite come far enough for me to really go with them, because I just thought that the quality of their dog still wasn't that fantastic. The quality of their training, I don't know, I wasn't quite sure about it. I mean, I liked a lot of their philosophies, but I wasn't quite sure that the end product really it was that fantastic. So I thought, no, I'll hang off for a little bit. When it came to retiring my dog, I'd had a couple of experiences in it at Guide Dogs. I'd gone in for some adaptive daily living training, what's it called, OT sort of training. And I found their attitude to be quite paternalistic and very, you know, you may not do this, you know, you must not do this, you may not do this, no, you're not allowed to do that. You know, you certainly can't have your dog in harness and work it, you know, around our facility. And, oh, my God, I was like, come on, I'm an adult. You know, like, give me some...
credit for brains.
That's right. So I thought, oh, well, maybe, you know, maybe this time to give CETA a go, because I really just didn't think that I could hack going back into training and sort of being treated. You know, I found that for me, they taught very much to the medium. You know, like if you were cluey, you couldn't do an extra walk or whatever. And I thought, I've heard good things about CETA in terms of their training approach. Maybe they'll be a little bit more flexible. And when I got my second dog, Winter, you know, it was great. I got to go in as a day student, so I went into class with everyone else, but I was able to go home at night, and that was fantastic. And the trainers, when they were talking to us, they'd talk to us as a class, but then they'd also provide you with individual instructions that were for just you and your dog. They weren't for anybody else. They were for you. And I found that really amazing, because it really, particularly as a second-time handler, it gave me a lot better insight into understanding a lot more about my dog and how she worked as an individual. And I thought that was really cool. And I found the same thing going back in for my third one. I had to retire my second one because she had atopic dermatitis. So basically, she was allergic to virtually everything in the world, I think, except for dust. I think that was the only thing on the screen that didn't show up that she was allergic to. So if I had have kept her, it would have meant a raw food diet, so raw meat and vegetables every night. And that doesn't work for me because, you know, I travel a lot. And carrying around raw meat on public transport, you know, or overnight to a motel and stuff like that wasn't really my idea of what a dog should be. So, I had to retire her. And, getting my third dog, Hermione, I mean, you know, it was, again, I got to be a day student, so, you know, taking her home overnight time. And, you know, it was a much shorter training program because, you know, I'd only just been in and got my last dog, so... And the training was really individualistic, and it was just wonderful. And I found the follow-up, you know, to be not too bad. You know, they're certainly equally as bad as guide dogs in terms of following you up, or equally as good. They've now started having a volunteer call you in between times just to see how you're getting along.
Yeah, that's good, isn't it?
Yeah, a really nice touch.
Yeah.
So it's been a really positive experience for me. And as for where I get my third dog, fourth dog, I should say, well, I suppose we'll see when the time comes, because I'm not really, you know, tied down to either school particularly. You never know, maybe by that stage I might train my own be having a chat about the benefits and downsides of owner training maybe in another 10 years or so.
I think that's not a good thing to have choice, isn't it?
Yeah. And that's the thing that, you know, I say to everyone, I think it's, I don't like, you know, bagging guide dogs, and I don't like, I think it's really important that we do have choices so that, you know, if one school does do the wrong thing by us, we've got a choice and we can and can have those decisions and make those choices. And I wouldn't like to see any of them sort of fail, because I really do hate all of this sort of rivalry, and it just drives me insane. I'm like, can't we all just get along?
I've actually just Geraldine speaking here, you know, I've actually found that the CETA have a very open approach. You know, they're quite happy for you to, you know, be involved and actually encourage you to, you know, join, go on waiting lists for both, and, you know, very positive and open about sharing. They're not quite so guarded about, you know, having others involved. Yeah, no, they're very good.
Penny, it's Greg. I got a question here. In your role, do you have much contact with puppy walkers? And in that respect, with we had discussion through this group on a couple of occasions about dogs that we've been partnered with that have obviously picked up bad habits during their puppy walking phase, you know, like grabbing socks and shoes and...
Oh, my God, yeah, don't even talk to me. I've got a bald, obsessed dog.
And we're considering putting together a fact sheet that we might send around to the different schools, asking them if they might pass it on to the puppy walkers, just, you know, with some positives and negatives about... what happens to the handlers when they receive these dogs with these habits?
Yeah, absolutely. It's unfortunately not something I get to do a lot of in my work, because I tend to work more with people using canes than dogs. So, and our Seeing Eye Dog facility, because, you know, Vision Australia is now, you know, part of Vision, SEED is now part of Vision Australia, so, but we're on separate campuses. So whilst I work from our Kensington office, which is where CEDA is also, you know, we are completely separate. We don't really get to see very much of what happens at CEDA, even though they're only a block away. It's quite ridiculous. But, unfortunately, it's not something I get to do a lot of. It is something that I'm really interested in dogs. And it is, you know, my absolute passion is sort of anything to do with their training, basically. And it is something I'd like to do in the future, is actually get more involved with those, you know, the puppy raising, that, you know, they have those groups and things like that, and sort of go along and talk to puppy raising groups, because I do think it is something that, yeah, it's so invaluable, you know, because, you know, they think that they make this decision, you know, oh, isn't that cute, you know, they're playing with a ball, but they don't realise what that actually means down the track. And even though the instructors say don't do this, I mean, they've got such a big list of do's and don'ts, and they don't often know the ultimate consequence, you know, is that I work my dog in a school, and, you know, she sees the kids playing down ball, and, you know, I can't walk in a straight line because she's trying to chase all the balls in the schoolyard. I mean, you know, come on. But how are they meant to know that when they've got this cute little adorable 8-week-old puppy in front of them, you know? So, I think
it would be an advantage for, you know, for those girls to have some contact with some guide dog handlers and just explain those things.
Yeah, look, I totally agree with you. And I think that, I think that there's a lot of things like that would be so beneficial, you know, for handlers to be getting involved with. I've been sort of concocting a PhD sort of research topic about, changes that have happened over time in dogs, and also in our handling, our expectations of our dogs, you know, how that changes over time, and, you know, whether we are, you know, whether our expectations have changed, or whether... You know, because I'm on an international guide dog list, and, you know, a lot of us are sort of saying the dogs that are coming out nowadays just aren't as solid as the ones that we've had previously, you know. They seem temperamentally to be a bit, you know, a bit all over the place. And is that just something that we're imagining, or is it something that's actually happening? And, you know, sort of looking at those changes over time, and how that differs too for people who've had multiple dogs in comparison to, you know, clients that are coming in new.
Yeah.
You know, what are their expectations, and are they being met? And, you know, are they different, or are they the same?
Yeah. Penny, I think that's a really good study. And Giselle speaking from Sydney again. And I would include, like, environmental factors, whether environmental factors have contributed, you know, whether more traffic, more you know, built up, more obstacles and everything like that could contribute to the... to the dog's behaviour, you know, changing.
Exactly, because, you know, people often say to me, so how does your CEDA dog compare to your guide dog? And it's like, well, I don't feel that I can really make that distinction because, you know, what I'm living a very different life than I was then. I'm working in very different environments. They're two different breeds of dog. I'm at a very different stage in my life. You know, the training was very different. They've both had different puppy raising experiences. You know, where do you draw the line between, yeah, what's the training program, what's the puppy raising experience, what's the dog breed, what's the dog personality itself, you know, and what's just me, you know? Yeah, I totally agree, you know. The environment's just hugely different. But, yeah, so are each individual dog, I suppose, too.
But there is a general pattern. There seems to be, and, you know, you're right, even on international list, there certainly seems to be a general pattern that the, and I've only had one dog, but quality of dogs there's been a change. There has been a change in the way the dogs are working, and but I don't think that anybody could put their, you know, fingers on it. But there certainly has been a change. You know,
I'd like to see whether that's the thing I'd like to sort of be able to maybe look at is there a change? Because, you know, we keep seeing these sort of reported changes.
At the moment it's like anecdotal evidence, you know, and where we can get some sort of scientific analysis would be good, you know.
Yeah.
But at the anecdotal level, this appears to have been a change. Yeah.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Mm. It's Nicole, and what I wonder with all of this is there more pressure on the schools? Like, is there more demand now for dog guides? I mean, we hear, you know, Australia's an ageing population and, you know, more people getting sight-related issues and whatnot, and, you know, more premature babies can be saved now than they used to be, but maybe some of those babies have still got issues. And so I'm just wondering, overall, is there just a higher uptake of people? And so because there's a higher uptake of people, then sometimes I get the feeling that some dogs have been allowed to go through and qualify as guide dogs, but maybe the dog just wasn't quite up to the standard it should have been. So, and I just wonder if that's an issue.
Yeah, and I totally agree with you. I mean, and that's one of the questions that I wonder too. You know, because and it's so hard to tell because, you know, like my current dog, she's a really clubby little girl, but the way that she approaches curbs, she's very sort of laissez-faire about it. Well, that's what it feels like to me. But, you know, my instructor said, no, she's stopping at this point. You know, she's stopping like about a foot back from the actual curb edge because she's got a better range of view. And it's like, well, how am I meant to know that that's what she's doing in comparison to her just being lazy about approaching the curb? And so when they've passed her and they've said that her curb approach is satisfactory, well, is it? You know, like, that's the thing. It's like... Yes, I find it very hard to tell, you know, and also what I feel is, you know, as someone with, you know, not much vision in comparison to what those instructors have felt. I mean, I know they do blindfold walks and whatever, but, you know, I wonder sometimes whether they use their vision rather than it's going to be like for the end user.
Yeah. They do,
Yeah.
And I was talking to my guide dog trainer the other day. I have with my dog, Nicholas, has got a little bit of a dog distraction. And I was just quizzing him about it in his early stages. And he told me that when he was doing the training with Nicholas, he could see other dogs approaching. And already at that point, before it got to a point where Nicholas was in a state where he was going to react, he'd already jumped on it. Whereas me... I'm unaware of it until basically the dog...
It happens.
Yep.
And I was trying to explain that to him, and he could see in the end, he could concede that obviously that would be a bit more difficult to be able to deal with.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think also, I can't remember what I was going to say. No, it'll come back to me, or not.
Yeah.
Any other questions for Penny there?
Penny, just Geraldine here. Are you currently doing your PhD?
No, I'm thinking about it.
Oh, okay. So this is because just you might want to take down my email address because I'm currently doing a PhD.
Oh, fantastic.
And I'm doing it on the health benefits of owning a dog guide, you know, because it's an area that's been... Sorry to jump in here, people, but I just got twigged on the PhD side of things. Looking at the social side, the emotional side, the, you know, lack of depression or whatever, but there's a lot of anecdotal evidence but not actually any sort of real research in that area.
Yeah.
A lot's been done on companion animals.
I thought there had been a study done on, it was in, I think, the JVIB a while back, the Journal of Vision Impairment and Blindness, on the psychosocial effects of dog guide ownership. I think it was done in the UK.
Oh, okay. I'll give you my email address before we leave, and if you want to flick me anything you know about that, that'd be great.
Yeah,
look
what's
at
your
that.
Address? Can I write it down now?
Yeah, sure, yeah. Anyone else who'd like to be part of my study, you know, feel free to take this email address. There's no pressure. All research is totally confidential. You know, I'm the only one who's going to have any sort of inkling, and I'll be destroying any questionnaires after I've taken the data out of them. So rest assured, you know, you won't be identified or anything like that. But I also need people who've chosen not to have a dog. Penny, perhaps you might be good there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Passing the word along, please.
I've got a few clients who will be fitting that bill. So.
Yeah, thank you. My email address is gell@iinet.net.au.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
And a good point to make, right? At that point too, is that if, you know, if we're going to make progress in the future or have some progress in the future that reflects, you know, the end users of the guide dogs, we need people like Geraldine and yourself,
yeah,
and others to get into the research field and push that envelope out as far as it can go.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely.
Yeah, thanks, Greg. It's true, yes.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only way, I mean, the only way that... well, let's say people who aren't blind or vision impaired are going to show any respect to people like ourselves is we're in the same fields that they are and doing the same work that they are, and even at the beginning they've got preconceived ideas, but soon they realise that we're just people.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and it's getting that message out to people, you know, that we are just people and we're capable of doing anything that anyone else is doing with the right support. So.
And sometimes better.
And sometimes better. Absolutely. Many times better, I think.
This has been a Dog Guide Handlers Australia audio presentation. If you would like further information on Dog Guide Handlers Australia or like to listen to further audio, please go to our website, www.dgha.org.au. Thank you. Do you always have to have the last word?